Members, I'm going to call the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Finance Committee to order. A quorum is present. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. The names appear to be misaligned with the titles, specifically with Representative Burkle and Representative Falconer. So the other, there was like another one too, I thought.
Oh, interesting.
And the other thing I would say is that Chad Kolstad was testifying to be, works at Minnesota Health Department and was testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Health Department and the PFA.
I would propose, as you might have heard whispering, that we will make the correction to him at the next meeting.
Great, thank you.
Good job finding some changes in the minutes. So we'll move on. Members, we do have a very full agenda today, so I'll be working to kind of move things along. If folks could bear with us as we attempt to do that, we'd be very grateful. I hate to have to push too hard, but we do want to get through our bills today. The very first bill up is House File 1531. That's the expiration of crossbow hunting and fishing allowance removed bill. We had quite a robust discussion on the crossbow issue just a number of days ago, February 26 specifically. So today the only action we're going to be taking is to move the bill to the General Register. We want to be sure that this one gets done. Representative Jordan and I have been trying very hard to get this one across the line so people can be ready to go and using their crossbow this year. So with that, I will move House File 1531 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying.
Hey, Mr. Chair, is there a DE amendment that we need to be? What version are we passing?
Representative Purcell, let's go ahead and move the amendment. So with that, I will move the technical amendment, the DE1. And I'll move that. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Let's try that again. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. All right. I can move this. I renew my motion that House File 1531, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. All right. Thank you, members. I'm glad we have taken care of that. Next up, House File 4146. Representative Igo, if you could make your way to the testifier's desk. Since you are not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 4146 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Your bill is before the committee. Please proceed and tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to be back in the Environment Committee. I actually have a very short technical fix bill in front of us today, and it's around temporary drill core storage. So those are familiar, we have a drill core storage library located in Hibbing, Minnesota, in my district. It is at full capacity, and we're finding amazing scientific discoveries around the state, and by law, those discoveries need to be stored at the core library. Well, the core library is full, and when we looked into statute, we can't take it and store it in places that aren't open to the public. So if we don't make this technical change allowing for the DNR to put this stuff into cold storage for a little bit, this scientific discovery and stuff that's been years in the making and will help scientists for years to come will just be thrown out. So this is a simple bill to create a sunset so that we can store some of this while myself and others keep working on a bonding request so we can build a better library. And that is the bill, members. And I believe I have one testifier from the DNR.
Looks like we have Joe Henderson. Joe, if you could make your way. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, chairs, committee members. Joe Henderson, Director of Lands and Minerals at the DNR. I'd like to thank Representative Igo for this bill and thank you all for the opportunity to testify. As Representative Igo said, Minnesota operates a Drill Corps repository in Hibbing that's highly regarded by people around the world. I know some of you have been there. For the rest of you, I hope to see you there someday. It's used by universities, government, researchers, and industry. Drill Corps is physical samples of bedrock collected through diamond drilling, and it's preserved so it can be studied. I gave the page a couple examples if you want to hand them out. It'll show those of you what we're talking about. Collecting drill core is expensive, offered hundreds of dollars per foot to drill and recover. The Hibbing Drill Corps Library preserves more than $500 million of geologic data, predominantly gathered through private investment. What was once proprietary exploration now forms a permanent public archive, allowing scientists, students, and industry to study Minnesota's subsurface again and again. Under Minnesota law, companies are required to offer the Department of Natural Resources a portion of their core when mineral leases are terminated so that it can be preserved and made available to the public. Our existing facility is full, as Representative Igo said, and we have sought funding for a new building, but that funding has not been approved. We expect to receive at least 9 semi-trailers of additional core this summer alone, and we have nowhere to put it. While we continue to seek funding for permanent storage, this bill provides the department limited flexibility to temporarily store core off-site. Temporary storage and trailer is an improvised. It's not a long-term preservation method for drill core. It's inefficient, it's expensive, and could lead to core being damaged. Any solution sort of properly storage in the future is kind of a stopgap. The department faces the real possibility of rejecting core if this bill isn't passed, and hundreds of millions of dollars of geologic investment and scientific information could be lost. Thank you for your help in this matter, and I invite those of you who have not been to Hibbing to see our library to come see it. It is amazing.
Thank the library Drew. Rocks, members.
And I wasn't allowed to make a joke. Thank you, Joe. I would like to just quickly open this up in case there is anybody here today that wanted to testify on this bill. I would limit time to 2 minutes per testifier. If there is anybody, I'm giving the audience an opportunity. Not seeing any folks wanting to testify further. Members, questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with your indulgence, if I could ask a question of the DNR that is not related to the bill, and I can wait if other people have questions to the bill.
That would be fine, but it'll cost you, Representative Hansen. Go ahead.
If there's anyone else that wants to go before.
You're the only one on the list. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Henderson, and I'm asking you because you're Director of Lands and Minerals, and I had a constituent ask me about Camp Coldwater Spring at the Confluence and DNR land, which I think is next to Interior land, and with Native American rights, and I think there's people are being forced to vacate there across from the Whipple Building, and just if maybe you could follow up or have the agency follow up with me or anyone else on the committee about that, just on where that ownership is and what the vacating order is coming from, if it's coming from the federal government or the state government.
Director.
Chair, Representative Hansen, I can look into that. I have no knowledge of that.
Okay. Members, anyone else with a question? Maybe related to the bill. Not seeing any other members with questions, I'll ask the bill author if you have any closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for the time today. Again, this is a very straightforward bill that's going to make sure we protect scientific data and let Hibbing's core library remain being the world institution for studying this geographical data. So thank you, members, and looking forward to hopefully getting a yes vote today.
Very good. I will renew my motion then that House File 4146 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. House File 3399, Mr. Johnson, Lake Elmo requirements to issue water use permits. Good question. Hang on a second, members. We're going to go to Representative Schultz's bill first. He has arrived. Representative Johnson, if you'd like to come forward.
I apologize for my late arrival. I've been doing this long enough to know that usually these don't go ahead of it. So I have
demerits, Representative. Demerits.
So yes.
You are not a member of the committee, Representative Johnson, I will move that House File 3399 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Your bill is before the committee. Please proceed and tell us about your bill.
Thank you. I'm just looking to see if my testifier is, oh, here, sorry. Go ahead, have a seat. So, thank you, Chair Heinzman and co-chair. By the way, it's cold out. Thank you. This bill is about, as we address the issues of housing and making housing available for affordability issues for people to move in, this bill addresses some of the challenges of doing that, and that is a situation that is out in Lake Elmo, a situation where they don't have the water and access to the water as a result of a court case that many know about. So I have brought my testifier here today to go into the technical part about it because it's a lot of science and water. And I'm going to turn to him right away, but this is what it's about, is housing for the community.
Please introduce yourself from the record. Go ahead and proceed.
Chair, members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm Clark Schroeder, Special Projects Manager for the City of Lake Elmo. I'm here today not to ask for money. I'm here to try to save the state $50 million and to provide housing for Lake Elmo. Lake Elmo is involved with a couple different issues. We are in the White Bear Lake lawsuit with court orders that limit water allocations. That's been going on for 14 years. We are also the heart of the PFAS plume. We're part of the 3M settlement fund and grant, which will be funding a $50 million treatment plant for the city of Lake Elmo in the south part down by I-94 away from the lake. The DNR will not promise an allocation to drill new wells with this $50 million plant if we are over our current allocation. As you know, Lake Elmo is growing and they're precluded by court order from increasing any water allocations for the 14 cities in the White Bear Lake area in the White Bear Lake lawsuit. And so we have the possibility, a real possibility, of this $50 million plant being built by one arm of the state, the 3M Settlement Fund, which has co-trustees from the MPCA and the DNR, and the DNR turning down our permit to drill wells for it and be mothballed. 3 years from now, there may be a headline that says, who knew that we were going to mothball a $50 million plant and basically waste the money. The water allocations in Lake Elmo, according to DNR's 2019 report, do not harm the White Bear Lake ecosystem. The DNR also says that groundwater does not jeopardize groundwater supplies for future generations. The DNR says groundwater does not degrade water quality in White Bear Lake. They establish a protective elevation for recreational uses only. This court order has nothing to do with the environment, groundwater supplies, or water quality. It's about boating. And without water, we cannot continue to grow. And Lake Elmo is probably going to add another 10,000 people to the city if we get enough water. Otherwise, you know, we basically were sued by the Met Council in 2004, forcing us to grow, forcing us to put in the infrastructure to grow, and now we may not have the water to do that. What I'm asking you is to consider Bill 3399, which would basically remove Lake Elmo from the White Bear Lake corridor and allow us the allocation to grow and fund, or basically allow us to fill our treatment plant. This bill is about clean drinking water over boating, and I would ask you to support those drinking water over boating.
Next up, I believe we have someone from DNR who wanted to testify today. Okay. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead, that'd be great.
Good afternoon, Chair Heinzman, committee members. My name is Melissa Kusky, and I'm the director of the Ecological and Water Resources Division at the Minnesota DNR. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to provide a few comments on House File 3399. As both the regulator of water use for the state and a co-trustee of the 3M PFAS settlement, we fully appreciate the City of Lake Elmo's concerns about meeting their important water supply and drinking water needs. However, we do have some concerns with the current bill language, both in terms of need and precedent. Regarding the need for this bill language, in October of 2024, the DNR amended Lake Elmo's permit, authorizing up to 472 million gallons a year, which was an increase of 212 million gallons. The authorized volume was intended to serve not only the current population at the time, but also provide for some additional growth. Using a 90 gallons per capita per day allotment, the permit amendment would serve over 14,000 people. We recognize that Lake Elmo is in the process of testing locations to install new wells as part of the drinking water supply plan developed for the East Metro communities associated with the 3M settlement, which provides funding for the communities to construct water treatment facilities to remove PFAS from the drinking water. And we expect the city will request an amendment to their permit seeking to authorize those new wells. This is the normal process and has been anticipated. And we've been in discussions with the city regarding potential future wells. We have an existing process for permit applications and amendments and don't believe there is a need in law, there is a need for a law that specifically directs a certain action. In addition to our concerns regarding the necessity of the proposed language, I would also note that this is a precedent-setting bill directing the DNR to authorize permittee-specific water use that not only effectively puts a permit-level decision in session law, but also permanently relieves Lake Elmo alone from the district court order required water conservation measures that would remain in effect for the other communities within 5 miles of White Bear Lake. These water conservation measures that were required by the district court order were contested by several communities, and that process is currently working its way through the courts. The legislature has provided the DNR with the statutory responsibility for reviewing and issuing permits to appropriate water and has mandated certain information and processes as a part of that statutory responsibility in order to ensure that sustainability standards are met. At a broader level, if this language becomes law, we might reasonably expect other communities and industries to seek legislative water allocations in the future outside of the statutory water use laws. Again, we fully recognize the city's challenges and concerns. We work regularly with the city as well as with the MPCA to discuss their needs regarding water supply, PFAS treatment, existing wells, and infrastructure needs, and we will absolutely continue to work with them moving forward. We'd be happy to work with Representative Johnson on the bill language. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Anyone here that would like to testify to the bill? Not seeing any hands from those here as members of the public. Members, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. I understand the situation that Lake Elmo is facing out there. I do understand that we have the court case out there that has made a number of findings, some of them that don't quite agree with what I've been hearing from the city earlier. You know, basically it's saying that the, you know, the courts found that the DNR is required by statute to make sure we've got sustainable use of the water permits out there. And they found that the current permitting that the DNR out there was not sustainable. And while it does impact a lake up there, DNR is charged with the responsibility of managing the lake for future uses. And other states that have not done that, from testimony that was in this committee back in 2013 when we were dealing with water issues, we saw in other states where people had gone to the point that they'd pumped enough out of the aquifer that the lakes would start drying up. So as a result, the lake is actually a barometer of what is happening in the aquifer there, and it's closely tied by tied together. Is there's a breach between the lake bottom and the aquifer, so the aquifer is kind of like a gauge of what's happening. The lake is a gauge of what's happening in the aquifer there. So as we see it going down, it tells us what is happening in the aquifer overall. Some of the things that is important to understand is that, according to the courts, they found that the current reliance on the groundwater in the area is unsustainable, and this extends not just in the 5-mile area, but outside the 5-mile area. And this is something that has been known for quite a while, that studies going back to 1998 that the DNR in its own studies was saying that the aquifer and the lake are tied together, that when one goes down, it'll drain the other, that when the aquifer goes down, it will drain the lake down. The question I have for the city is, you have a chunk of money available out there for $50 million. Is there a reason you're not looking at using that dollars instead and trying to connect up to one of the surface water supplies that is out there instead of going down to the aquifer?
So two things. The DNR, when I quoted what they were saying, this from a 2019 memo that they put out, I can certainly share that with the committee if they're interested, but this is from the committee. In the court findings, 20 years of Lake Elmo pumping on the effects of on White Bear Lake is 0.1 foot over a 20-year period, almost unmeasurable. We get more on a rainy day than Lake Elmo pumps that affects the lake in 20 years. It's insignificant. The reason that the $50 million is not being considered is during the 3M settlement discussions after 2019, in 2020, the metro area, the five main cities, which you're aware of, developed a conceptual water plan, and it was determined that they wanted to not bring surface water out. I have asked, actually, I have a different opinion, but I wasn't here in 2020. I was not here in 2020. I've asked the White Bear Lake Group, actually, as part of the 15 studies in that work group that we're working on trying to stabilize the lake, everything from bringing surface water to cities, bringing surface water, treating it, dumped in the lake, stormwater reuse, all these other water conservation issues. I have asked that Lake Elmo be included in a surface water conversion. I've been told by the engineers it's most likely is not practical to do that, since we have almost a no effect on the lake, 0.1 foot over a 20-year period. The return on investment is just not there, according to the people. But it will be part of the study. We will come back to this committee this time next year. Our report will be done from the White Bear Lake Group in June of 27, and we'll be back here to give this report with our recommendation to say, what is the solution that we can use to support the elevation in White Bear Lake?
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman, and thank you for the work that you folks are doing in the group out there. I will say is, while it may not seem like a lot of water that you're doing, is the DNR is charged at looking cumulatively. And when you add everybody cumulatively together, everybody cumulatively together is having a significant negative impact on the lake. And so the decision comes in at a certain point, certain people, certain communities are either going to lose that right or going to have to find other ways to supply the water, because collectively together, it appears, according to the judge's order, that more water is being drawn out of the aquifer than is sustainable for the lake. And so this is the tough problem that we've got to deal with going forward and have to come up with a solution instead of always going down the aquifer. Somebody at some point is going to have to give up some of the access they have to the groundwater now and or find surface water to come in to help take care of it. And that's just going by what I'm seeing from the judge's order here. Legislatively and collectively, we've sent down to the communities to try to find an answer, because if we don't come up with an answer, the judge is going to impose something on. And originally, when they were dealing with the DNR before we went to this process, the DNR actually had proposed a solution of cutting people's permits back to the point that the only people getting water in the communities with a domestic water supply would be homes. They were talking at that point even cutting off hospitals. That's the dire situation we have. And so we need to take a look at how we manage this going forward. And I expect the group, as they're looking at it, is trying to figure out ways that we reduce the demand on the aquifer, which right now needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. And members, that's why the bill is being laid over today. Give everyone enough, hopefully, time to figure out what our options might be. I do not have any more names on the list for questions, so Representative Johnson, if you'd like to make some closing comments, I would invite you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing this bill today. This is a subject that is going to affect a lot of communities. It does affect Lake Elmo and their requirement to grow, their desire to grow and to provide housing. As you've heard, that this lawsuit is affecting it. It has an arbitrary 5-mile distance put around that those communities are limited to what they can actually pump. I haven't heard anybody tell me the reason for that 5 miles other than when that was decided. And the challenge and the interesting fact is there's communities outside that 5-mile area that are pumping more water out of White Bear Lake than Lake Elmo is, but Lake Elmo is limited because of that 5-mile number. So as we move forward, hopefully it has come back to us next year, but I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. So I will renew my motion that House File 3399 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you.
You bet. Representative Johnson, don't go far. House File 4017 up next.
I won't go far. I'm just starting to warm up.
I was worried. Again, since you are not a member of the committee, Representative Johnson, I will move that House File 4017 be recommended and be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. I will also move the author's A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like for today's discussion. Members, all those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Johnson, the bill is in the shape that you would like. So it's before the committee. I think that we have a number of testifiers. Washington County Commissioner and Carla Bingham. Whoever would like to go first?
I'll start off. Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, members. Thank you. As I was mentioning somebody earlier, I was going to bring treats as a tradition, but I figured with what we're about to see here, nobody would be hungry. So I just want to skip
that.
I think
you're right.
So House File 4017 is a bill that brings some enforcement teeth to the existing state law. Again, we're not creating new law. We're just putting enforcement into it. The Infectious Waste Control Act has been on the books since 1989. It requires generators of infectious and pathological waste, including blood and body parts, to segregate that waste from the general trash and send it to facilities that are specifically licensed to manage infectious waste. Unfortunately, that does not always happen, and infectious waste is getting mixed in with the general municipal solid waste and sent to our local waste management facilities. This is a bill that is actually taking into account workers' safety. Workers are going and separating trash, as you know, the garbage from here and the garbage from all of Ramsey County, Washington County, go to Newport at the Recycling and Energy Center. Everything goes there, and it gets gone through, separated before it goes to various different ways of disposal. This facility was purchased and redesigned to meet the mandate and the guidelines from the state to 75% diversion from landfill. We have these workers going out there every day, and just providing for the families, and they all of a sudden, they come in and all of a sudden they look down and there's a bag of blood, body parts, feet, to the point you don't know if you're calling the sheriff, 911, or what you're doing, and it's causing the facility to shut down and clean and passing on the cost and then putting these people at danger. I'm going to pass off to Commissioner Bingham here to talk a little bit more what's going on.
Commissioner, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Washington County Commissioner Carla Bingham. I have the privilege of sitting on the Board of Ramsey Washington Recycling and Energy, which is a joint powers board comprised of commissioners from both Ramsey and Washington County. I also had the privilege of being a member of this institution back in the day, and the other one. when the trash arrives at the R&E Center, as Commissioner Johnson stated, it goes, my bad. When the trash arrives, it's on a tip floor, which is, for those sports fans, the size of a football field. And there's conveyor belts that really have the material go through a series of shredders and screeners and magnets, and they recover the recycling, you know, materials. And then the remaining materials are turned into refuse derivative fuel, and that is used to generate electricity. So the R&E Center processes over 1,000 tons of trash each day, enough to cover a football field 6 feet deep. So the mechanical processing, though, requires our incredible workers to clean the items every day. And then, you know, when there's something gets plugged in them, they have to go in there, and if they get wound up, they have to go pull everything out. So when infectious waste is present in the general trash, our employees end up exposed to unknown, potentially life-threatening pathogens. And when that infectious waste load comes into our facility, we can, if we can identify it prior to processing, that has to be separated out. We have to call in somebody that is a special team that's licensed to take care of the infectious waste. And this impacts our workflow on our tip floor, increases the cost of our operation, and also the haulers get pulled into that as well. Furthermore, being confronted with human blood and body parts on the job creates traumatic experience for our staff. So, you know, the concern is not with a Band-Aid or a tissue from a bloody nose. We are talking about blood and body parts that are liquid, squishy, and moist. Our tip floor does not need to look like Ed Gein's freezer or barn. We do not want that. There's a collection of photos in your packet that will explain and show some of the samples of the sorts of infectious waste that have come through the R&E Center in the past few years, and actually just yesterday another load came through. So as Representative Johnson stated, this is a worker safety bill, and we appreciate their dedication, professionalism, and hard work that they bring every day, and they do not deserve to be exposed to this kind of life-changing diseases that could potentially begot them or suffer from PTSD from being, you know, exposed to this and confronted with this material. So we thank Representative Johnson for carrying this legislation and all the co-authors, which I know there's a few in this room, and we are hopeful that this legislation will give us the accountability that we are seeking and compliance that we are seeking through the oversight, penalties, and training. So I'm going to turn it over, Mr. Chair, with your approval, to R&E employee Brad Prozac to talk about his experience dealing with the infectious waste.
Go ahead, Brad. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brad Prozac. I'm a 25-year employee of Ramsey Washington Recycling and Energy Center. I'm represented by the IBEW Local 23. I'm here today to discuss the infectious waste that's entering our facility. I'm hoping to give you some insight into the disturbing and grotesque items that we've been forced to deal with. This is not a new problem. It's been going on for my entire career. In 2023, Channel 9's Corin Hogard, and in 2025, Channel 5 Eric Chalou both did stories that helped bring this matter to the front and center. I can tell you that I've personally seen bones, flesh, hair and scalp matter, soft tissue that I can't identify. I've seen large quantities of blood, items such as IV tubes, vials, filters, and rags. One container that I will not forget was labeled monkeypox. I'll never know if that's what it was, but I don't want to ever see it again. There are several hundreds of pictures taken by myself, coworkers, Clean Response, for all who want to view. People have a hard time looking at these photos, let alone see them in person. There are a couple of ways this infectious waste is entering our facility. Number one, the direct haul from the generators to the R&E Center. This is the easiest way for us to identify it, as we are informed as they enter the building that they have medical on them. We can inspect the load with a quick walk around, but once we've identified it as infectious waste, the labor-intense work starts. We have to cone off the product and inform management. We have to identify the truck number, the pickup location, and the set up and sorting area to clean response so they can go through the load. This is a huge task while still trying to operate a tipping floor of heavy equipment, garbage trucks, semis, and now add people hand sorting infectious waste. The number two way it enters is not so easy. The infectious waste comes in on trucks mixed with tons of other regular waste. This can easily be processed if we can't see it. It is not unusual to see these same bloody items caught on conveyors, wrapped in discs, and hanging from rollers. These items need to be removed by the employees that want nothing to do with infectious waste, and I don't blame them. We use PPE, but it is not enough when you accidentally grab needles, bloody bags, tubes, etc. We deserve to work in the safest environment possible. This can be avoided, and it needs to be avoided. Thanks for listening to our story.
We appreciate hearing. Thank you. Next up, I have Michelle Benson. You know the process, I don't have to tell you, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Fisher, committee members, and Representative Johnson. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 4117. My name is Michelle Benson, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association, our 139 hospitals and health systems across the state. Minnesota hospitals share your commitment to protecting public health, keeping waste management workers safe, and ensuring the responsible handling of infectious waste. Our facilities operate in highly regulated environments under MDH, MPCA, OSHA, CMS, the Joint Commission, and the CDC. We already maintain extensive policies, staff training, and compliance systems to prevent improper waste handling. Even with strong training and compliance system, mistakes can occur in busy clinical settings. However, the penalties in this bill represent a dramatic and unprecedented escalation. The bill is unclear on how violations would be counted per load, per incident, per day, potentially multiplying penalties by hundreds of thousands and even into millions of dollars in penalties. For a small rural hospital, a fine of that size could jeopardize their ability to continue serving their community. As I review the language, penalty language on lines 2.4 to 2.12, the parameters of the penalties are unclear. If a hospital has three violations over a 10-year period, a 20-year period, or a 30-year period, are they subject to a fine of up to $2 million? Would they also be subject to sanctions against their license? A hospital would have to be perfect over an undefined period of time or face extreme sanctions. In addition to the extraordinary fines, on lines 2.13 to 2.16, the bill requires MPCA to send half of those fines to the receiving waste management facility. We are not aware of any other area in state law with statutory penalties of this magnitude, nor the requirement to share fines with a reporting entity. We all want a system that protects workers, the environment, and public health. But House File 4117, as written, could unintentionally harm the very hospitals Minnesotans rely on. We urge the committee to reconsider this approach, align consequences with current regulatory construct, work with hospitals, waste management partners, and regulators on a balanced solution that will strengthen safety without threatening access to care. We remain available to work with the author and stakeholders on solutions going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. We have PCA up next. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. First off, just want to thank the author and Ramsey and Washington counties for bringing forward this bill. It has been a very difficult situation, I know, for Ramsey Washington County, their facility, and their workers. In general, through conversations with parties, we don't believe this is an isolated incident that's occurring at this facility. And there are waste likely going to other locations across the state that are infectious. This bill is a good start. However, we believe there needs to be a larger holistic approach to this issue that would require education and outreach, increased inspections at the generators, such as is looked at in this bill, updates to the law in terms of compliance and enforcement tools being made available, along with modernization for the risks that are being faced today for infectious waste, and also the practices of healthcare industries and the like. All of this will take additional resources to move forward, including the language in this bill for inspections to be done unannounced. Currently, based on previous history at the agency and that, there were a few incidences of this that were sent to us for addressing. We work on a complaint-based compliance and enforcement mechanism. Moving to a required number of inspections per year would require additional staff at the agency. Just a little bit on the penalty component here. The legislature should decide on what the penalty thresholds are. Some do believe the current amounts for penalties are not accurate or high enough to affect deterrence and changing behavior. There does need to be some clarification in the penalty matrix currently in law to understand where infectious waste fits within it, and so additional work in this area would be welcomed. There also does need to be a process for facilities such as Ramsey and Washington County to address the costs they're taking on. As mentioned, they have contractors coming in having to specially handle this waste, which are large costs. There needs to be some type of mechanism for them to recover it. There may be other ways to do it, hazardous waste. For instance, under 116.071 has a mechanism that could be modernized for infectious waste to be able to do it if the mechanism in the bill is not what the legislature is looking to do. At the end of the day, the issue of infectious waste does need to be addressed, and we believe a more holistic approach, comprehensive approach, should be taken, and that there will need to be additional resources to carry this out. We'd be happy to work with the legislature as they move forward in how to address infectious waste throughout the larger system. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
That's the end of the testifiers that had signed up before our hearing today. So I will open it up to those in the audience. If you would like to take 2 minutes, feel free to approach the testifier's desk. Please introduce yourself for the record. Yes, the mic is on, although you might have to go a little closer. Go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Sam Hall, and I'm the facility director at R&E. And we've been dealing with this infectious waste issue for the last as Brad mentioned earlier, for many years, but we've been actively working on resolving this issue for the last 3 years. And the parties we've been working with have been the MPCA, Minnesota Department of Health, the hospitals, everyone. And I've dealt with OSHA inspections, I've dealt with union grievances, and this needs to stop. And this is our attempt at doing something different to expect different results, because the last 3 years of talking with other stakeholders have not worked. So I just appreciate your consideration and time. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Why don't you stay in case there's questions?
Not seeing anyone else in the audience. Members, questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, it seems like we used to take care of this with incinerators at the hospitals. Is that correct?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, there are some waste-to-energy facilities that are licensed to handle smaller amounts of infectious waste. Our facility is not permitted to handle infectious waste, and the waste or the fuel that we make is sent to Red Wing and Mankato to waste-to-energy facilities that are not accepting infectious waste. And they have the same employee health concerns as well.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would there be a way of, at the generator site where this material, which is people, you know, it's people, is there a way to immobilize it? I know I've been to trade shows where they offer, even like with computer parts, to pour them into resin or some type of agent, and, you know, that you would have something that's not touching other people. Some way of encapsulating it or binding it and disinfecting it all at the same time at the generation site so it doesn't get to the transfer site.
Who wants to take that? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, these hospitals and generators have plans in place. They have red bag waste to separate their infectious waste, and then it goes to often to a facility called Stericycle or other similar facilities, and they have an autoclave process. So, yes, and that's maybe a question better directed to the hospital groups, but yes, I'm assuming they could have smaller equipment to then manage it, but it's still the poor management of the infectious waste plan that is causing this. So they have, we're not getting all their infectious waste, we're getting enough to where it's a danger, and so they have waste that's being disposed of properly through the infectious waste plans, but then there's infectious waste that's being improperly mixed in with the solid waste, the good garbage, and coming to my plant.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it, and thank you, Rep. Johnson, for bringing this bill forward. Before I make my comments, I'm just going to say I'm going to vote for this to go out, just to set the tenor of the tone. But I do think that the Hospital Association's concern about the penalties, specifically the time horizon on that, is at least for me, is well taken. You know, without kind of some sort of parameters as to when these different events occur, you know, a hospital that has been clean for, you know, 20 years between incidents could still potentially suffer an escalated, you know, violation. So I would just recommend, you know, as this bill continues on in the committee process, I think it's going to Ways and Means next, to maybe think about an amendment to add in some sort of time scale to those penalties. You can decide whatever it is, but I would like to see that in the final version of the bill before it is voted on the House floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before the bill goes to, I like to call it Ways to Be Mean. Think of Representative Godfrey. I think I'm with you. I think that conversation is probably worth having. I like to equate it to a retailer that is licensed for alcohol or tobacco, right? The tiered system and the penalties increase with each violation, hoping to get that compliant. So, and you know what? There is a sunset on that when the license resets. So probably something to think about. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your support.
Members, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And I was just curious if Michelle Benson with hospitals could just come up for a quick question. So currently you talked about how many hospitals are in the state that you
Mr.
represent?
Chair, Representative Gilman, there are 139 hospitals in the state
Wonderful.
Of Minnesota.
Wonderful.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. Curious, Director Benson, right now currently the hospitals are getting billed for this, they're getting fined at this moment. Is that happening, incurring right now?
Ms. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, there are a number of corrective actions that are taken. For example, if infectious waste shows up at a facility, is identified to a hospital, that hospital is then billed for the cleanup. They are responsible for correcting that error, and there are financial consequences. There's also the PCA has authority to fine, assess a corrective action plan. There's one that is publicly available that is demonstration that there are authorities in place, and from the hospital's perspective, we are continuing to train, continuing to invest in stopping infectious waste going into the solid waste stream. It is, it would never be intentional that any of our infectious waste would end up in the solid waste stream, but human beings do make errors, and with tons of waste coming out of hospitals, there will be mistakes. And so we're doing our best to minimize those mistakes, but there are sanctions available at the PCA.
Wonderful.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. That answers my question. Thanks.
Any other questions, members? I'm not seeing any more questions, Representative Johnson. Before we go on to the motion, I would just say that there had been sort of a different process we had in mind for this bill going forward, and those that have concerns and thoughts on this bill I would ask them that they would work with you, the bill author, Representative Johnson, if there's other ideas that could be incorporated into this, and hopefully we can get at the problem as effectively as possible. So go ahead, and if you have any closing thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chair, and members. This is really is a worker safety issue. This, as we can see, as during the testifying, this has made news, Channel 9, Channel 5. There has been, even with the publicity out there, there has been a continuing of delivery of infectious waste being continued. There has been multiple attempts being made to solve this. There continues to be. I'd rather not be here, but it's an issue that we've now gotten to that I've heard some good solutions. I've heard of a hospital organization, hospitals that have put in extra steps, hired more people, made different steps so it before it gets there. So in other words, you have the people upstairs and they make a mistake, the people downstairs are going through it again. So there is ways to stop this from going, because those people, I understand, once they did that, hasn't been coming forward. But this really does come down to dollars and cents. Once this dollar amount got high enough, the hospital started reaching out and saying, uh-oh, we got to take this seriously, because now it's more a pocket profit issue. Before that, there wasn't enough teeth, there wasn't enough seriousness taken, and the math was done. So we need to make sure that this puts some teeth in it so we can keep our workers safe, so they can go and provide for their family, can prepare to go home, don't have the issues of seeing, I don't know what you guys would experience if you walked along and saw a bag open up with what these workers are seeing on a regular basis. This isn't just onesie twosies. It's been how many days in a row now it seems I get a text that something's been delivered. So it's not getting better, it's getting worse. We have to take the steps. I understand there's work that needs to be done on the bill so everybody's on the same. I had those conversations. Those amendments that you saw took into account the concerns of those that came forward to me to try to clear that up. They're ready to be cleared up. But we need to make sure we let those who are going and doing their job for us, that they are taken care of and they don't have to deal with that every day for them to go home to their families. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 4017 be recommended as amended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You're on your way to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson. Next up, House File 4019, Representative Schultz, Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer, appropriation permits. Representative Schultz, as a member of the committee, go ahead and make the motion.
Mr. Chair, there's a deep desire that I have to get this bill across the finish line this session in some form to fix the problems for my community and a specific group of Minnesotans who do not have access to water for specific purposes that they need economically, so that we have the ability to be viable to live in the community that we do. Mr. Chair, while that is my desire, as we engage in this conversation today, the motion is to lay this over for further conversation.
The bill is before the committee members. Representative Schultz, go ahead and explain the bill. I should mention that there is an amendment, but we're going to start with your comments before we get to that motion. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And co-chair and members of the committee, this is a bill in its current form, 4019, which is modified from our conversation last year, but has to do with the exact same thing, relating to the Mount Simon aquifer and specific communities in this state who don't have another aquifer to pull from. As you recall from our conversation a year ago, There are farm families in my district and on the edges of my district that follow the map, which is in your packets today, where there is no other aquifer for them to pull from. And so currently, if it's not for drinking water, there is no other solution for them to have access to water. And it only impacts very small portions of this state. So today, as we engage in this conversation, and I'm grateful, Mr. Chair, that we have additional time, what I want to pose to us all in this committee on either side of the aisle is to take an approach of being a problem solver. I've hopefully laid out for you that we have a problem, that besides for drinking water, there is no other way for constituents of mine and in a neighboring district for people to have access for any other purpose. So today we have two different sets of language before us. And I'm gonna ask in a moment for the testimony from the people who are interested in this conversation, but I want us to be problem solvers together because I'm not tied to any one solution. And I think that we need to be collaborative in our approach and we need to do what's right by Minnesotans, both here today and for future generations. And that's why I think that both the bill and the DE are a good place to have that conversation. So that's what I'm committed to today. And I would ask for our testifiers now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz, thank you. So first up on the list I have is Mr. Rory. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie, Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. We have farmer members who are in the unique geography that Representative Schultz just described. You'll remember the Wilson Tree Farm that visited the committee last session. There where I get my wreath every year in Isani County. We appreciate your attention to solving this issue for them. There's lots of pressing needs facing Minnesotans, and we appreciate your attention to this pressing need facing these farmers. I remember testifying last session on this along with the Wilsons, and concerns were raised about making sure this was a limited exemption just for agricultural use and for that narrow band of farmers that find themselves in that geography where their only access to water for an agricultural use is from this aquifer. That's a concern that I'll say that we share. Our intention is just to make it available for those folks who farm there and for whom that's their only alternative. So I appreciate this committee's continued work on it, the multiple drafts that Representative Schultz has worked on, and appreciate the continued conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Director of Ecological and Water Resources, Melissa. Back at the rostrum again. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Heintzman, committee members, hello again. I'm Melissa Kusky, and I'm the director of the Ecological and Water Resources Division at the Minnesota DNR. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a few comments on House File 4019. The DNR understands the need that this bill is working to resolve, and we've been working on this issue for the past several years, first with Senator Coran and more recently with Representative Schultz. In 2021, protections for the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer were expanded to the full extent of the aquifer beyond the 7-county metro. This change eliminated non-priority one uses, meaning that uses besides domestic water supply, it eliminated those uses for those that may not have other options, closing the door entirely to many uses in a large portion of the state. The DNR supports the revised language that's reflected in the DE1. We see this language as cracking that door back open just slightly, with key safeguards and the ability to restrict as needed through our statutory responsibilities. As described, as discussed a little bit earlier about the bill language, and I'm sure you've been able to read through the package, the language provides the authority to the DNR to allow use of the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer for domestic uses inside the 7-county metro and for additional uses, excluding non-essential uses outside the 7-county metropolitan area, provided that the commissioner determines that there's a need, that water conservation measures are included, and that all other provisions of statute are met. Since 2011, the DNR has maintained and expanded an extensive network of wells to track water levels over time. This network is shown on the map you have in your packet, which also shows the geographic extent of the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer. We anticipate that the need for this build provision will typically occur along the edges of the Mount Simon where other aquifers are absent. Water levels in the Mount Simon aquifer have been stable for the past 15 years across our monitoring network, and with the provisions in this bill, we believe we have the necessary tools to manage requests for uses of the Mount Simon where there are no other feasible options to meet a limited water supply need. We believe that the bill and existing statute positions Minnesota to wisely use this resource in sustainable ways. Thank you. I'll remain available around for questions.
Next up, I have Mr. Hillman, MCEA. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Heintzman, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Hillman. I'm a water resources specialist at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this HF4019. MCEA is a public service law firm and advocacy organization that has been defending Minnesota's environment and the health of its people since 1974. MCEA strongly opposes the DE amendment to HF4019. The Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer is one of the most important sources of drinking water in Minnesota. It stretches across the metro area and most of south central and southeast Minnesota. This aquifer is deep, clean, and old, with water at the minimum of 1,000 years old. It will take lifetimes to replenish water that is withdrawn from the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer. For many municipalities, this aquifer is crucial to their ability to provide drinking water to their residents, which is why the legislature banned new appropriations from the aquifer in the metro area except for drinking water in 1989. This prohibition was then expanded in 2021 to cover the entire aquifer. The 2021 law did not revoke existing water appropriation permits. Existing water permits are grandfathered in under this law. Existing permittees are even still able to drill new wells as long as the total volume does not exceed their permit appropriation. This DE amendment would reopen the aquifer to nearly all uses in areas outside of the metropolitan area. This includes industrial uses like data center cooling. This is not a theoretical concern. Data Practices Act requests by MCEA around a data center proposal in North Mankato revealed that the city and a data center developer had identified this law protecting the aquifer as an impediment to a data center proposal that would consume up to 30 million gallons of water per day for cooling. This is equivalent to approximately 100,000 households per day. Emails between the city and the lobbyist for the city discussed the need to repeal this 2021 law. Now HF4019, as amended, would effectively do exactly that. The legislature was correct in 2021 to protect the aquifer for drinking water use. HF4019, as amended, is a mistake that would reverse that protection. While the original bill was more narrowly tailored to specific ag irrigation uses, the amended version would open the oldest, cleanest, and most precious source of Minnesota drinking water for use for AI data center cooling, threatening our highest priority use drinking water in an already stressed aquifer. Water's our identity, it's our strength, and we have the responsibility to protect it to the future generations, and this is a finite resource of an aquifer under strain. We oppose this HF4019 as amended and ask you to oppose it as well. Thank you.
Next up, Jim Berg. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the DE amendment to HF4019. My name is Jim Berg. I'm a retired Minnesota DNR hydrogeologist and principal investigator for extensive Mount Simon-Hinckley aquifer investigations from 2008 through 2015. I oppose the DE amendment to HF4019. Our research confirmed what had already been suspected, that this large, high-quality resource was essentially finite across most of its extent and needed to be used carefully. Weak regulations prior to 1989 allowed overpumping beneath the Twin Cities metro area, creating a large, depressed water level area up to 200 feet. This depressed area, or cumulative cone of depression, as it's called, persists today, reducing the usefulness of this aquifer for future needs. Use of this aquifer should be limited to human consumption across most of its extent. In 1989, the legislature banned new appropriations from the aquifer in the metro area, except for drinking water, and expanded this prohibition in 2021 to the entire extent. A repeal of these restrictions and the threat of new high-volume appropriations from hyperscale data centers creates a serious risk of overuse problems again. In these very slow recharge aquifers, once lowered water level areas develop, they persist for generations, maybe centuries, we don't really know. Even if the pumping is reduced or eliminated, this vital natural resource that will be badly needed in the future, possibly due to persistent drought, will be badly compromised or not available at all. The original bill was less threatening by introducing agricultural irrigation as an additional use. This ag use may be appropriate in some parts of the state, but this version is an unfortunate reversion to the bad old days of groundwater regulation in Minnesota. Again, I oppose the amendment.
Anyone else from the public want to testify today on this bill? I am not seeing any hands. Members, any questions? Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Heintzman, I'd have a question for the DNR.
Very good. Yep.
Thank you, Ms. Kuski. Thank you, Kuski. As you're taking a look at the Mount Simon Hinckley aquifer, does it respond? We know down here in the metropolitan area it's got water that is quite old. What is it like as you go to the northern part of the state, the northern reaches of the aquifer? What is the characteristics of it? What is the size of it? Is it the surface aquifer? Is it, and what is the age of the water up there? I understand it's a little different than what we have down here.
Director Kuski, I think there's about five questions there, so hopefully you're writing fast. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Chair Fisher, I will indeed have to phone a friend on that and provide some follow-up responses to you. I'm not one of the hydrogeologists of the department. The aquifers you can see on the map does extend well north of the metro area, and we have been seeing stable water levels, but it is, I mean, the aquifer does is just generally a deep old aquifer.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. That's part of the reason I'm asking the question is I've heard part of the reason that it has the name it does is because it becomes closer to the surface around the Hinckley area. And so I'm just trying to get a better understanding of the dynamics of the aquifers, because I know aquifers change as you go down different parts of the state. And so I'd like to have more information on that, because that could help guide what this conversation is like in the future. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Go ahead, Rep. Gottfried.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Something popped into my mind, kind of based off of what Co-Chair Fisher had said. And another question for Ms. Kuski. I think in your initial testimony, you had said that, and you just reiterated it now, that this had been a pretty stable aquifer for some time. But I don't, I'm curious. Based off of the DE amendments that we have in front of us about in non-seven county metro area, if this aquifer could sustain, a huge daily draw on it, that like say a data center that Mr. Hillman talked about, I think he referenced something like 30 million gallons per day. And potentially multiple data centers, because there's multiple counties outside of the seven county metro area where these data centers could be potentially developed and stuff. So, you don't necessarily need to answer that right now. You said you're not the hydrogeologist there, but I would be curious to see, what research of how much draw it could take for various uses outside of the seven county metro area
and still remain stable? Because I think that's important information for us to know as we continue to evaluate this entire discussion. Thank you.
Director Kusky, I think that Representative Gottfried indicated that he recognizes this is probably a question that can be answered offline. But if you do have anything, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, what I would say in response is that is information that we could follow up with. And then typically we would be looking in any event on a case-by-case analysis of this. And so because there are locational variations, and so that would be a necessary part of any potential project analysis that would come in. As a general matter, I think in our review of the bill was premised on the perception that we wouldn't be looking at widespread, huge uses, and so that isn't something that we've necessarily compiled in envisioning some sort of large withdrawals at this point.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the discussion of the development of these large water users, and I know we're having a lot of debates in this committee around large water users, it would be helpful to have more information under the assumption that there may be some widespread development of these sorts of things, or at least know what that would actually look like and how that might strain our natural resources that we have. Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, just for frame of reference on process right now, currently we have the bill in front of us. I have not made the motion for the DE1, just so that we're following our process here. What I'm going to do for the sake of our discussion is I'm going to move the DE1 for our discussion, and then I would ask Mr. Chair if the DNR could walk through the DE1, as this is language that is brought to me by the agency.
Director Kusky, does that work?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Schultz, with your plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, with the amendment in front of us, I would ask the DNR to walk through this for the sake of the members' understanding of what their language would do and how, whether it's large water users or whether it's irrigators for trees, how this amendment would be handled.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the language in the DE1, to sort of lay the playing field here, you'll notice it's considerably longer. The purpose for that was largely clarification and specification of some of the language that has existed in statute for some time. A key interest that the department had was to replace the word potable with priority one uses. Potable isn't defined anywhere else in statute or in our rules. And based on how the state's water priority use is determined, we thought that was an important clarity improvement. And so that is it. That is a first change. The second kind of changes is that it separates out into two pieces that have sort of similar language. The first piece is within the 7-county metro, limiting use to just the priority one uses, which are those domestic supply. And then the second piece is for other uses, excluding non-essential uses. And then third, the original bill language and the language that has been in statute for some time speaks to, no feasible or practical alternatives and a water conservation plan. We thought it was valuable to provide additional specification as to what those actually, what indeed a water conservation plan meant. And we intended it to specify that it incorporates best available water conservation technology practices into a permit so that it had more specificity and impact and regulatory clarity. I thought it was important to specify that the permit be consistent with the requirements and of 103G 255 to 103G 2991, and 103G301 and 103G315. Those are the kind of critical components of our water use statutory language. And so that was ultimately the premise of the DE amendment language that we had worked with and provided to Representative Schultz, was mostly from the DNR's perspective to provide some more specificity, to have more meaning in terms of the actual requirements that would be included if the department were to consider any appropriations, additional appropriations from the Mount Simon.
Representative Schultz, how would you like us to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wanted her to be able to provide this to all the members so that you could understand that there is differentiation between the metro counties and the rest of the state, and to say that the DNR and their stewardship has been carefully thought out to ensure that for anyone who proposes a large water use, that there are additional stipulations and law in place to ensure that we are taking care of and stewarding well the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer. I believe in that too, and I want you to know that. I believe in that too. And so I bring this before the body, and I would just ask if there's any other questions that members of the committee may have on the DE1, and just deal with it that way.
Members, any questions? I'm going to give you extra time, members. Representative Schultz, I'm not seeing member questions. Do you want to adopt the DE1?
Mr. Chair, at this moment, I am going to withdraw the DE and keep the bill in its current form.
All right. Representative Schultz withdraws the DE1. The bill remains in its current form. Any closing comments, Representative Schultz?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So this bill is still being laid over. It is my desire that we continue this conversation. We have 2 weeks before I want to see this bill moved out of this committee. I think that there is plenty of time for us to work together to find solutions to this. House File 4019 that's before us, without any additional changes, simply states that we are dealing with agriculture irrigation outside of a metropolitan county. And so if you are outside of the 7-county metro, this opens the door specifically for agriculture irrigation. So I'm asking for your support for this, and we can continue conversations on this with the DNR and with each and every one of you so that we get this right together to solve this problem for Minnesotans most in need.
So, Representative Schultz, are you renewing your motion that House File 4019 be laid over?
Yes, sir.
The bill is laid over. So, we are at the end of our agenda early, so we are going to have a few extra minutes. We are adjourned.